I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. In a week after another UN resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza, supported by Russia, China and the UAE, was vetoed by the USA and Britain. President Lula of Brazil, the current rotating chair of the UN Security Council, has labelled the UK-US-EU nation-armed aerial bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip a genocide. For weeks now, and as thousands of children have been slaughtered, Israel's principal sponsor, the USA, has argued against a ceasefire, with its State Department and tech companies attempting to censor news coverage of Israeli aerial bombardment of a church, schools, hospitals and mosques. Joining me from Granada in Spain as US warships arrive in the Middle East is Israel's former foreign and security minister, Professor Shlomo Ben-Ami. He's now vice president of the Toledo International Center for Peace. Thank you so much, Professor Ben-Ami, for coming on. I've got the book here, Prophets Without Honor. It came out only months ago. Before I get on to a really important theme in that book, would the events of October the 7th have happened if you were still Foreign and Security Minister of Israel?
Well, I wish this was the case, but the thing is that I am fully aware of the reasons that brought us to a failure then. And the conditions were not ideal, I must admit. The conditions today are far better. The conditions before the war, a few days before the war, we had an envelope of friendly Arab states that could have been helpful, particularly helpful, in moving the process ahead. During our time, that was not exactly the condition with the Saudis, with the Emiratis, and others. So I think that the regional setup now, or before the war, rather, or the day before the war, was much more friendly to a viable peace process than in our days.
I suppose what you mean there is, if you were foreign and security minister today or on October the 6th, it could still have happened because of Netanyahu, because you said that what made and enabled the bloodshed inevitable was Netanyahu.
Well, I what I mean by that is that the blunder by the Netanyahu government and by him personally has to do with his strategic misunderstanding of the realities. He did believe that the Abraham Accords, this change of paradigm, was his own doing, and it reflected defeat of the National Palestinian Movement. He said that when he met Biden at the General Assembly a fortnight ago or so, he said that the Palestinians should not be allowed to have a veto right on a Saudi peace deal. And as we see, they are having sort of a veto right that is being expressed through this flare-up between Israel and Gaza. And then, of course, from this strategic blunder, emerges the tactical blunder. Otherwise, he would have had military forces deployed along the Gaza border and not put all his attention in protecting the settlers in the West Bank.
I mean, I've said this on the programme a few times recently. We're not all fans of Thomas Carlyle. You can't just put it all on Netanyahu. And in fairness, in your book, you show there are huge security structures in Israel which were bound to fail almost. It's not just his fault, clearly. There's an entire architecture of security and defence forces in there that didn't even understand that this multi-billion dollar wall of Gaza and so on was kind of useless.
No, you're right. I mean, what I was addressing you was your particular question about today, about the reasons that we have this failure today, failure to understand the strategic conditions. But historically, I'm fully aware, and I write about it in the book, of the entire security and civilian establishment being involved in the occupation of the territories. This is not something that has to do with just one prime minister. This has been going on for the last half of a century. Already in the 1980s, there was this incredible wise scholar and sort of politician, Meron Benvenisti, who spoke about the situation being irreversible. I mean, because the realities that were created through the settlements and the security establishment and what have you. Yet, I would advise against the assumption that just because of these realities, it is entirely impossible to have a political solution. I mean, we could have a political solution even then and today. Even today, this Israeli notion of blocks of settlements that can be swapped with with Israeli land, is still, at least technically, if not politically, it's still viable.
I want to get on to those clear, and I think that's why the book is so interesting, actual possible solutions rather than the parroting of this phrase, two-state solution. And as you say, you know, at the beginning of your most recent work, I mean, coming from a former foreign minister, that what you've written is an obituary of this two-state chimera that we hear politicians talking about all the time during the slaughter in Gaza at the moment. So why do you think that, as you mentioned the history, the first reaction from Israel's UN ambassador to Secretary General Guterres saying that the attacks on October 7th did not occur in a vacuum was to call for his resignation and to immediately refuse visas for United Nations staff in the region?
This is utterly unhelpful. I know Guterres, where he comes from, ideologically and politically, I don't think that he meant exactly what the way he was interpreted.
He just said it shouldn't be under. It didn't happen in a vacuum. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think he was condoning the 7th of October massacre. I don't believe that that was what he meant. But anyway, the politics of boycott and of ruling out UN officials from, I think this is utterly ineffective, and it is not right, and this is not the way Israeli diplomacy should behave.
And that has accompanied media appearances by Israeli former ambassadors, maybe people who used to work for you, who knows, calling Palestinians animals. And this simultaneous to reports we're hearing that Antony Blinken told the Qatari government to tone down coverage of their satellite news channel. Is there a concerted attempt and is there a concerted worry now by the Israeli government and the United States sponsors that these pictures, which they can't control on social media of dying children, means it's even worse than in the times when you were foreign minister in terms of the atrocities the world is seeing?
Well, you know, that's a dirty war. It is a dirty war on both sides. I'm not an expert in international law. I'm afraid that it is very sad, but I'm not sure that the death of civilians as such is a war crime. I think that targeting civilians is a war crime. And I tend to believe that the Israeli forces do not target on purpose civilians. As we saw the other day with this debate about the hospital, it turned out, I think, fairly, I don't know if you would agree, but to me that was quite convincing.
Well, now the New York Times, as you know, is rowing back from that, and most people say that if you blow up...
Exactly.
If you drop the amount of...
So I think that...
Well, no, because I have to say, I mean, if you drop the amount of TNT equivalent to Hiroshima on a space like Gaza, you're going to kill civilians. You're in effect targeting civilians. But I suppose this has happened so many times. And what's unusual about your viewpoint is that you've said Oslo was a waste of time. As chief negotiator at Camp David, you've itemized what was going on and said that the problem is that Israel has never had a leader that understood the tragedy of the displacement of Palestinians and what the Palestinian story actually is. But what are the interests of Biden, Sunak, Scholz and Macron coming to appear beside Netanyahu? What's your understanding of why they did that?
Well, this is quite unprecedented in the history of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and it needs to be understood, in my view, in two ways. One is indeed the shock about the 7th of October, and the second is the strategic understanding of these leaders that what is going on in Gaza is part of a broader showdown with an opposite bloc, Russia, Iran, possibly China as well, that is being defined, determined through the war in Ukraine as well. So Ukraine and Gaza are seen in terms of their strategic broader setup as part of the same conflict. On the other side, you have Hamas, which is an ally or being cultivated in a way by Iran. You have Hezbollah, which is again Iran. You have Iran itself. You have Russia, which is allied with Iran in Ukraine and beyond. So that's their understanding. This is the way I interpret it. So on the one hand, you have the shock at the carnage that took place along the border on the 7th of October, and the second is the broader strategic setup.
Yeah, so in your work, you haven't really highlighted that element of Israel being a proxy project, which seems to be how the Global South appear to be saying it. The fact that Lula said what Israel is doing is genocide, the B in BRICS, as it were, does that mark this out as very different to all the previous flare-ups of killing and slaughter? The idea that, as you say, this is now seen as Israel is seen, forget the Israeli people, and in your book you actually almost say that it has been used by outside powers, but now it's really being used by outside powers as a buttress against this new multipolar world that we hear all the time from Beijing and Moscow about.
Yeah, but Israel would have reacted, and this is my main critique of the Israeli side, is that it doesn't have a clear political strategic purpose. It doesn't know it is a reactive war. I think that Israel would have reacted anyway with Western support or without it.
Professor Shlomo Ben-Ami, I'll stop you there. More from Israel's former foreign and security minister after this break.
Summer, the melting Arctic snow reveals abandoned machinery, millions of rusty barrels, and the detritus left by human expansion into this most inaccessible of territories.
Я, конечно, был в шоке, как можно было так засраться по самые помидоры. Это просто печальное зрелище.
Volunteers from Clean Arctic travel to Heise Island, home to the biggest polar station on the Franz Josef Land archipelago.
Сера, грязь непролазная. Боже мой, я тут еще целый месяц.
У меня были первые мысли. Нас обманули, нам подсунули какой-то самый стрёмный остров во всем архипелаге.
Это одна из самых северных земель на нашей планете, от которой до Северного полюса примерно 1000 километров.
The Arctic pioneers' main objective was to explore and conquer these harsh lands. They had no time to think about waste management. Now their legacy could remain for centuries.
Как мы, наверное, человечество в целом выглядим, наверное, нелицеприятно. Такое чувство, что мы засрём эту планетку, а потом полетим куда-то делать это еще.
Чистый север, чистая Арктика!
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Israel's former foreign and security minister, Professor Shlomo Ben-Ami. You were just saying that Israel would have reacted regardless of American support, to which most people would say, well, hang on a minute, Israel doesn't have any enough arms without American and British and European Union nation to reply in this some would call savage way against the civilians of Gaza. Could it?
You mean rearming the or replenishing Israel's military arsenal?
Yes.
Well, I guess that, yes, the U.S. has done it in the past as well. It did it during the Yom Kippur War, and it did it after one of these cycles of wars with Hamas. You're right, this is American support is something that cannot be denied. And the fact that the Americans moved their aircraft carriers to the Eastern Mediterranean, again, it has to do, in my view, with the broader strategic setup, which I mentioned earlier. They, I think that more than participate in the war, they came to deter Hezbollah and the Iranians. But if I may, I wanted to say a word about Lula, if this is possible. I think that we should be careful, and it is not easy during times of war, to avoid the prostitution of the language. The Palestinians are not animals, and Israel is not conducting a genocide. We need to calculate our words. Is it really a genocide? You know how many people died in drones attacks by Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq? I don't know if at least 80,000 or close to it. And nobody say this is a genocide. I think no need to prostitute our language.
Okay, well, President Lula's been on this program.
It is sad enough. It is sad enough without it.
President Lula's been...
It is sad enough, tragic enough, even immoral enough without it.
Okay, well, I mean, we have heard Israelis in the past week or so in London, I think the Israeli ambassador to London, speak of it in the same terms as Dresden. Not saying it as if Dresden was a terrible atrocity, but saying Dresden was a necessary atrocity, which many people think was quite bizarre. But you've said, as regards what's happening in Ukraine, that the only beneficiaries were the US arms industry. How far do you think that Biden and Blinken, Blinken, of course, himself, former Pentagon consultant company boss, how far is this war also being promoted by the vested interests of arms companies that have benefited, obviously, by the masses of arms being poured into Zelensky in Kiev, but also being poured into Israel?
That's not only the war. I mean, the entire American assistance to Israel is an indirect subsidy to the war, arms industry in America. This is dollar money that has to be spent in the U.S. it cannot be spent in Israel proper, which means that from the very beginning, it's not only during the war, but during normal times, American aid can be seen as an indirect subsidy to the arms industry. When I wrote, and I wrote a piece about Ukraine, I did say, and I stand behind what I said, that the main winner in this war so far has been the American arms industry, because the fact that the West as a whole is in this war without having an end game in mind. What is the objective? And I didn't think a few months ago, and I don't think it now, that the Russians can be thrown back to the international border. I don't believe this is a realistic objective, and therefore some sort of accommodation would have to be found and through a ceasefire, and then start some sort of negotiations. But otherwise, this war will go forever, just as the war with Hamas. I don't think that, I think that is the main weakness of the Israeli position, is that it doesn't have a political objective. This is lesson one that we learned from Clausewitz. I mean, what's its objective? Destroying Hamas entirely, bringing it to its knees, it will take months, if not years, if it would be possible at all. So, and then an invasion might trigger a wider conflagration in the region and beyond. So I think that the fact that there is no strategic objective is one of the reasons that perhaps opens the door to this critique of Israel's bombardment. What is the objective? What is the strategic endgame? And this is where Israel is failing.
Well, we know who's paying for that failure. Of course, some might say this is this eschatological idea in Washington that they're fighting China, they're fighting Russia through Ukraine, and they'll fight Iran and the burgeoning Arab world, I suppose the Islamic world, through Israel. But unlike so many other voices on this situation, you talk about, rather like Palestinian scholars as well, talk about a one-state solution. Now that there are 130 so-called settlements, 140 so-called settlement outposts, 70,000, occupiers are there in East Jerusalem as part of the old UN resolution. Just outline why you've said this and why it is some reason we still hear this two-state solution parroted phrase from politicians as widely different as Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, and Joe Biden.
Well, I think it turned out to be impossible to reconcile the minimal requirements of the Palestinian National Movement for a peace deal with Israel's maximal capacity for making the necessary concessions. These two ends simply could not meet because of the unique nature of the conflict, being a conflict not just about land. It's not land for peace. It's there are categories that Israelis and Palestinians cannot agree on, and it is the question of refugees, the question of holy sites, Jerusalem. This is not a real estate business like we had with Egypt, that is giving back the Sinai Peninsula and then getting a peace agreement for it. Here, the you see what the Egyptians and even the Syrians during negotiations were asked to give Israel is a political legitimacy. Give Israel political legitimacy in the region. What the Palestinians are asked to give is political and moral legitimacy. And that is what makes the Palestinian position so maximalist in the eyes of Israeli negotiators, because you have to pay a price that goes far beyond the problems that were created in 1967. You are being asked to give a price that has to do with the problems of 1948, the problems created in 1948. And the Israeli political system the collective Israeli public is incapable of paying that price. It is exceedingly high. And if you'll have a prime minister that would be willing to pay the price, then he will be toppled politically. One of them was assassinated and two others were defeated politically because they came too close to meeting Palestinian requirements for a peace deal. So this is why I came to the conclusion that this is the two-state solution and as we understood that it then, that is the borders of 67, swaps of land, removal of settlements at a large scale, the partition of Jerusalem, Palestinian control of the Haram al-Sharif, Temple Mount, all this to me is not possible given what I understand is the political Israeli system and what I understand are the conditions in Palestine, with this split between Hamas and PLO and the problem.
I mean, as we run out of time, given the inability, it seems, for anyone to understand that this is the case, whether it be international powers, Security Council members, what do you expect the outcome of this current conflict to be? Because as we can see, the Arab and Islamic world, certainly the Arab world, doesn't seem to want to save the people of Gaza the way Russia sees the saving of the people from eastern Ukraine. But there are resistance movements around the world. There are obviously boycotts beginning. There is now a widening protest movement all around the world. It's very different to think that there are some polls that you're 40% of Jews in the United States believe that Israel is an apartheid state. How should we expect this conflict to move? I suppose it depends what happens in Lebanon.
Yeah, I think that we need to look at the immediate steps and what is possibly to conceive longer term. In the immediate step, I think we should drive to a situation whereby, according to the very clauses of the Oslo Accord, that the Palestinian Authority will have its authority extended to the Gaza Strip.
That's
as well.
That's not going to happen.
Well, it might happen if the Hamas is diminished to such a degree, because this is not going to be, in my view, a war of a few weeks. It will go on for a long time. If this happens and there is a willingness to inject the financial capabilities and the security capacities to the Palestinian Authority, maybe we can restart some sort of peace negotiations. Otherwise, what I believe, what may happen at some point, is that the Zionist DNA, as it were, as I understand it, the Zionist DNA, as I understand it, was always more about demography than about territory. That is, it was perverted by the settlers, by the coalition of Netanyahu, by the shift of Israelis to the right since the year 2000. It was perverted into making territory prevailing over demography. I think that at some point, a prime minister will emerge that will do what Ehud Olmert tried to do in 2006, that is a convergence plan to start disengaging unilaterally from parts of the West Bank in order to prevent the dilution, the entire disappearance of the Jewish state into what I call a South African situation without a South African solution. This is a one-state reality. I don't see to such a one-state reality, I don't see a South African solution. So maybe this such a unilateral withdrawal, which is not the best solution. The best would be one negotiated settlement. But if this does happen, it will force inevitably the Jordanians to ask having a role in the West Bank. This will be very bad for the Jordanian kingdom because you will see movements of population from the West Bank to the other side of the river. If the Israelis eventually decide to conduct some sort of unilateral disengagement in order not to consolidate a South African situation, which would be suicidal for Israel.
Professor Shlomo Ben-Ami, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for the show. And condolences from the whole team here at Going Underground to those bereaved by the ongoing violence in the Middle East. There will be more Gaza on Monday's show with British historian and Tony Blair speechwriter Sir Lawrence Friedman. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.